Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Parashat Naso, which means to take up or to lift up. And so it's talking about take a census. It's literally talking about taking up a counting or carrying, I guess would be another way to put that, carrying a counting. So this idea of a census, say, is not a light matter that's going on with this. So we'll be starting in Numbers chapter 4, starting in verse 21 and continuing on through the end of chapter 7. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Take a census of the sons of Gershon, also by their fathers' households, by their families. From 30 years and upward to 50 years old, you shall number them, all who enter to perform the service, to do the work in the tent of meeting. This is the service of the families of the Gershonites, in serving and in carrying. They shall carry the curtains of the tabernacle and the tent of meeting with its coverings and the covering of porpoise skin that is on top of it and the screen for the doorway of the tent of meeting and the hangings of the court and the screen for the doorway of the gate to the court which is around the tabernacle, the altar, and their cords and all the equipment for their service. And all that is to be done, they shall perform. All the service of the sons of the Gershonites, in all their loads and in all their work, shall be performed at the command of Aharon and his sons. And you shall assign to them as a duty all their loads. This is the service of the families of the sons of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting. And their duties shall be under the direction of Itamar, the son of Aharon the priest. As for the sons of Merari, you shall number them by their families, by their father's households. From 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, you shall number them, everyone who enters the service to do the work of the tent of meeting. Now this is the duty of their loads for all their service in the tent of meeting. The boards of the tabernacle and its bars and its pillars and its sockets and the pillars around the court and their sockets and their pegs and their cords with all their equipment and with all their service. You shall assign each man by name the items he is to carry. This is the service of the families of the sons of Merari according to all their service in the tent of meeting under the direction of Itamar, the son of Aharon the priest. So Moshe and Aharon and the elders of the congregation numbered the sons of the Kohathites by their families and by their father's households. From 30 years and upward, even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service to work in the tent of meeting, their numbered men by their families was 2,750. These are the numbered men of the Kohathite families, everyone who was serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moshe and Aharon numbered according to the commandments of the Lord through Moshe. The numbered men of the sons of Gershon by their families and by their father's households from 30 years upward even to 50 years old, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting. Their numbered men by their families, by their father's households was 2,630. These are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Gershon, everyone who is serving in the tent of meeting, whom Moshe and Aharon numbered according to the commandment of the Lord. The numbered men of the families of the sons of Merari by their families, by their father's households, from 30 years and upward even to 50 years, everyone who entered the service for work in the tent of meeting, their numbered men by their families was 3,200. These are the numbered men of the families of the sons of Merari, whom Moshe and Aharon numbered according to the commandment of the Lord through Moshe. All the numbered men of the Levites, whom Moshe and Aharon and the leaders of Israel numbered by their families and by their father's households, from 30 years and upward, even to 50 years. Everyone who could enter to do the work of service and the work of carrying in the tent of meeting. And their number of men was 8,580. According to the commandment of the Lord, through Moshe, they were numbered, everyone by his serving or carrying. Thus, these were his numbered men, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe. Chapter 5. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, command to the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp every leper and everyone having a discharge and everyone who is unclean because of the dead person. You shall send them away, both male and female. You shall send them outside the camp so that they will not defile their camp where I dwell in their midst. This the sons of Israel did so and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moshe. Thus the sons of Israel did. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel. If a man or woman commits any of the sins of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord, and that person is guilty, then he shall confess his sins which he has committed, and he shall make restitution in full for his wrong, and add to it one-fifth, and give it to him who he has wronged. But if the man has no relative to whom the restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution which is made for the wrong must go to the Lord for the priest, besides the ram of atonement, which by which atonement is made for him. Also, every contribution pertaining to all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel which they offer to the priest shall be his. So every man's holy gift shall be his. Whatever any man gives to the priest, it becomes his. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, if any man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him, and a man has intercourse with her and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, although she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him and he is jealous of his wife when she has defiled herself, or if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife when she has not defiled herself, the man shall then bring his wife to the priest, and shall bring as an offering for her one-tenth of an ephah of barley meal. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of memorial, a reminder of iniquity. Then the priest shall bring her near and have her stand before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel. And he shall take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. The priest shall then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose and place a grain offering of memorial in her hands, which is the grain offering of jealousy. And the hand of the priest is to be the water of bitterness that brings a curse. The priest shall have her take an oath and shall say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray into uncleanness, being under the authority of your husband, be immune to this water of bitterness that brings a curse. If you, however, have gone astray under the authority of your husband, and if you have defiled yourself, and a man other than your husband has had intercourse with you, then the priest shall have the woman swear with an oath of the curse. And the priest shall say to the woman, the Lord makes you a curse and an oath among your people by the Lord's making your thigh waste away and your abdomen swell. And this water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach and make your abdomen swell and your thigh waste away. And the woman shall say, Amen, Amen. The priest shall then write these curses on a scroll, and he shall wash them off into the water of bitterness. Then he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse, so that the water which brings the curse will go into her and cause bitterness. The priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy from the woman's hand, and he shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. The priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial offering and offer it up in the smoke on the altar, and afterward he shall make the woman drink the water. When he has made her drink the water, then it shall come about, if she has defiled herself and has become unfaithful to her husband, that water which brings a curse will go into her and cause bitterness, and her abdomen will swell and her thigh will waste away, and the woman will become a curse among her people. But if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will then be free to conceive children. This is the law of jealousy. When a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over a man, and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply all this law to her. Moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt. Chapter 6. And the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink, or shall he drink any grape juice, or eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation, he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grapevine, from the seeds even to the skin. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall let the locks of hair on his head grow long. All the days of his separation to the Lord, he shall not go near to a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother or for his brother or his sister. They die because of his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. But if a woman dies very suddenly, but if a man dies suddenly beside him, and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day when he becomes clean, and he shall shave it on the seventh day. Then on the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the doorway of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, to make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. And that day he shall consecrate his head and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite, and shall bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering, but the former days will be void because of his separation was defiled. Now this is the law of the Nazarite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. He shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without defect for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without defect for a sin offering, and one ram without defect for a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened cakes of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil along with their grain offering and their drink offering. Then the priest shall present them before the Lord and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. He shall also offer the ram for sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord. Together with the basket of unleavened cakes, the priest shall likewise offer its grain offering and its drink offering. The Nazarite shall then shave his dedicated head of hair at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair on his head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. The priest shall then take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up. And afterward, the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford, according to his vow which he takes, so he shall do according to the law of his separation. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, thus you shall bless the sons of Israel. You shall say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I will bless them. Chapter 7. Now on that the day that Moshe had finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it with all its furnishings and the altar and all its utensils. He anointed them and consecrated them also. Then the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' households, made an offering. They were the leaders of the tribes. They were the ones who were over the numbered men. When they brought their offerings before the Lord, 6 covered carts and 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders and an ox for each one. Then they presented them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, accept these things from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, and you shall give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service. So Moshe took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 carts and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon, according to their service. And 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Itamar, the son of Aharon the priest. But he did not give any to the sons of Kohath, because theirs was the service of the holy objects, which they carried on the shoulder. The leaders offered the dedication offering for the altar when it was anointed. So the leaders offered their offering before the altar. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, let them present their offering, 1 liter each day, for the dedication of the altar. Now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Aminadab, of the tribe of Yehuda. And his offering was 1 silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull, 1 ram, 1 male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the service of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, 5 male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Aminadab. On the second day, Nathaniel, the son of Zuar, leader of Issachar, presented an offering. He presented as his offering 1 silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the weight of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 bull, 1 ram, 1 male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, 5 male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nathaniel, the son of Zuar. On the third day, it was Eliab, the son of Helon, the leader of the sons of Zebulun. His offering was 1 silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, 1 silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, 1 gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, 1 young bull, 1 ram, 1 male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, 1 male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, 5 male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. On the fourth day, it was Eleazar, the son of Shedur, leader of the sons of Reuben. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the weight of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with an oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Eleazar, the son of Shedeur. On the fifth day, it was Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai, the leader of the children of Shimon. His offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five lambs, male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. On the sixth day, it was Eliasaph, the son of Duel, the leader of the sons of God. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. On the seventh day, it was Elishama, the son of Ammihud, the leader of the sons of Ephraim. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for burnt offering, one male goat for sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Elishama, the son of Ammihud. On the eighth day, it was Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, the leader of the sons of Manasseh. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur. On the ninth day, it was Abidan, the son of Gideoni, leader of the sons of Benjamin. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Abidan, the son of Gideoni. On the tenth day, it was Ahizer, the son of Amishadai, leader of the sons of Dan. His offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai. On the 11th day, it was Pagiel, the son of Okran, leader of the sons of Asher. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Pagiel, the son of Okran. On the 12th day, it was Ahira, the son of Enan, leader of the sons of Naphtali. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. This was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. 12 silver dishes, 12 silver bowls, 12 gold pans, each silver dish weighing 130 shekels and each bowl 70. All the silver of the utensils was 2,400 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The 12 gold pans full of incense weighing 10 shekels apiece according to the shekel of the sanctuary. All the gold of the pans, 120 shekels. All the oxen for the burnt offering, 12 bulls. All the rams, 12. The male lambs, 1 year old with their grain offering, 12. And the male goats for a sin offering, 12. And all the oxen for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 24 bulls. All the rams, 60. All the male goats, 60. All the male lambs, 1 year old, 60. This was the dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. Now when Moshe went into the tent of meeting to speak with them, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two cherubim. So, he spoke to him. So thus concludes the reading. And so, you might be wondering, why was that we just didn't start with verse 84 and go, etc., etc., etc.? Well, one of the key lessons that you have in this is that everyone is counted. That's the whole point of this book. It starts from the beginning of Numbers and goes to our discussion we had earlier about who gets counted in this mix. Is it, do some people get left out? Or is it that you have an inclusive came out?
My question is, as we were doing this, and it would say what tribe was responsible. And as I was looking, you know, and for example, Judah, the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Issachar and Reuben. But then I got the two that I didn't recognize, you know, Ephraim, and I know that I should, and then Manasseh.
Yes.
Manasseh, but I'm missing, you know, as I went through this, I also marked off on the 12 tribes here, and obviously I'm missing Joseph and Levi.
Aha.
So I'm guessing those are these two tribes, but I don't know where the names come from.
Those are the sons, some great, interesting sons of Yosef. Those two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And those are, when he talked about, when you go back at the end of Genesis, where it's talking about the life of Yosef, and he said he had two sons, and he named those as basically talking about, it's kind of interesting because he named them based upon forgetting where he came from, kind of releasing it was his former way of life with his other 11 brothers, and as he was living down there in Egypt. But it's quite interesting that you have these two names that are all about detaching yourself from where you come from. Yet they end up coming in and becoming a part of the family, so, becoming a part of the 12. So much so that, as you noted, Levi and Yosef are taken out. So Yosef then, his sons become a part of the count. You don't hear a lot about, and you talk about the tribes, you don't have the count of the tribe of Yosef. It's always talking about Ephraim and Manasseh being in there. Yes, because really, if you were to look in there, if you were to even just leave Levi in the mix, then you'd end up with 13. But often when you see these counts, Levi is taken out. And you see even kind of the end of the last portion, that's kind of Bamidbar, which is the numbering, the census, that the tribe of Levi is given the special separation because they are the ones who are, you could say, are running interference. They're the ones that are the connection between the rest of the people and God's house. And that comes in to be very important when we start talking about their roles, but they're separate from the rest of the tribes. So you see that in the dedication of the altar is where the people are bringing in, because as we started the beginning part of Leviticus, if you might recall, that Leviticus is all about bringing the offering, the korban is all about approaching. So you're approaching the presence of God, you're approaching where God is, has his embassy. And the offering is what comes in and basically takes your place going into God's presence, and then gets burnt up, consumed, either eaten by the priesthood. It gets you, and through your offering, get consumed by God and his direct employees, the Levites, and more directly the priesthood, or come in from the family of Aaron, which are these three here, the Kohath, Gershon, and Merari, which are the sons of Levi. And out of the subset out of Kohath is where you get Aharon and his sons then become specifically the high priesthood.
I'm presuming you're going to go into this, but I noticed the pattern with the word naso, or take up, with that first verse that you read where it talks about, then the Lord said to Moses, take a census, and that word is naso, or a variation of it. But later on in that whole context of the woman and the guilt offering, the jealous husband offering, in Numbers 5:31, it says, moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but the woman shall bear her guilt. And that word for bear is also that exact same word of naso. So are you going to talk about that at all?
Yeah, because we're talking about what is it that all of these things have to do with each other, and about the idea of bearing together, so bearing burdens, but also burden in the greater sense of a role.
Just one more question I have before we get rolling on this. When we were talking about what she was just talking about, the husband and the guilt, it's like, it kind of seems like at the beginning, nothing's proven there. It's just all on the assumption. So I'm just wondering where does this guy get this guilt, thinking that his wife is fooling around on him when there's never been any judgment or anything, and then it all goes on to her. And nothing is about him. I mean, he's the one that has this guilt that he might possibly shouldn't have, but yet there's nothing about him having to do any kind of a vow or a ritual or a rite for his own problem, which could be the jealousy. I mean, where is this coming from? Why is he jealous of his wife? And it says something about the spirit of jealousy, but I'm just wondering if there's any connection or what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, because normally, remember we were as we were going through Leviticus, it was talking about that if you bring an accusation against somebody and it's not true, and you go through something that's pretty serious, well, that penalty then comes down upon you because you're trying to make a false accusation. or something. So the lesson in that is you don't just level any sort of anything you want against somebody. And it's also in the same context of gossip and tale bearing. It talks about it in the same general area, because you don't slander somebody, you don't make false reports, a false testimony, bearing false witness. That's why it's among the top 10. So like 10 commandments, the 10 statements, that's what that literally means. You can extrapolate it out to just general lying, but it specifically means, that's why it's like among the big 10, you don't bear false witness against somebody to take their life. That's what it literally means. And then you can extrapolate that further. You don't even just give general falsehood and try to mislead people and for devious ends and such. So the root meaning of what the 10 words is all about is you're not trying to seek someone else's destruction, because it goes back to, because that goes right back to the do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Would you want somebody to try to frame you for something? No. And neither would you want to frame somebody else for something, to accuse them. So thus you can see one of the grave things that was happening in the trials of, that are specifically mentioned in the apostolic writings of Yeshua and of Stephen specifically, but also you'd see it later of Peter and Yohanan as they were brought in before the Sanhedrin, the council. They were bringing these false accusations. That's one of the big 10 that they were violating in this, because it became clear to even members of the Sanhedrin that, hey, these testimonies aren't jiving, you know, the stories are changing, so something's wrong here. So what their duty should have been is then to go after these people who are making the false accusations, and they didn't do that either. So thus you've got a falling down of that. And that gets a little bit toward the spirit of jealousy we were asking about before. Because what is the picture there? Because generally, when you're talking about slander, making, bearing false witness and such, that's got to come down on the head of the someone who's bringing this out. So there must be something else going on here about, because it's in a general section where it's sandwiched right in between removing the unclean from marching into the tabernacle, you know, because they think they're just fine. And in between the Nazirite vow, where these people are specifically called out for a specific purpose. And you start seeing some specific examples of the Nazir later, where we get the term Nazirite from. And the interesting play on words that comes from Nazir and Nazir, where we get Nazareth or Nazareth, Nazarene, because it comes from a little bit of a play on words, because in some pronunciations, even though they're in Hebrew, they're spelled differently. In some areas of the country, specifically in Galilee, the Galilee area, that the pronunciation of Nazir and Nazir are very similar together. So kind of the idea of where you end up getting the transliteration into Greek is being almost identical between the two of them. So that's why you get that, he will be called the Nazarene. It's got that kind of dual thing, because it could be called a Nazir or a Nazir. One meaning a crowned one, the Nazir meaning the crowned one, because it's a word that applies both to the high priest. The high priest, when it talks about his turban, and he will wear a Nazir on the front of it, and it says holy to the Lord on it. And to the other Nazir, which is what we're looking at in Numbers chapter 6. So these two people are crowned. Their crowns may be different, but a special service nonetheless. And the Nazar is a general meaning, mean branch, a something that came from something, a root of something where it comes out, which is where the term for Nazaret or Nazareth comes from. It's thought to come from.
Getting back to the idea of the jealousy of the husband coming upon him, I know if it's not written there, you know, like it didn't happen. So, but say for instance, the wife is there, and I don't know who else is there, just the priest and the husband or the whole congregation there? I don't know. That's one question. But, okay, so say the wife is in front of the ark, right in front of the tabernacle, right? I mean, she's been called right in front of the Lord, and they're asking her to swear and put a curse upon herself if she's, you know, guilty of it. If at this point she doesn't want to really swallow that juice that they've made up for her, you know, she just says, and she confesses, you know, that she did. I mean, it's not written there. But would she be free from drinking that stuff, or?
Yeah, because basically you're facing that if you say, okay, yeah, I did it, that's adultery. And that's another one of the big ten, which is then, you know, death penalty. Or the other one is that it goes through the abdomen swelling and the thigh swelling is a euphemistic way of saying you're becoming barren, because it says later, then she'll be able to have children. So the idea being that that's euphemism for becoming unable to have children, basically being made sterile. So it's like, well, do you want to become actually dead, or basically, you know, dead to the world around you? Because it's one of those things that in the culture that we're talking about, the childbearing was seen as a huge, huge aspect of a person's identity. I mean, today we talk a lot about, you know, the man's identity is his job, and see a lot of people fall into depression if they go through long periods of being out of work and you can't get a job. And then you also see that challenge in retirement. You know, if you don't have something to do, some sort of goal, purpose in life, people start rapidly declining. I know some people who just recently entered retirement, and you can just start seeing that, wow, really hope that person gets a something else to do in life. Because in some cases, retirement can be a curse if you don't find who you actually are beyond what you do, who you are. You see that earlier on when talking about, you know, in Sarah, the wife of Abraham, that, you know, she was like, oh, wow, I'm barren. So she starts going to all kinds of lengths with Hagar, bringing her in to bring the child, because that was seen as her whole identity wrapped up in that. That is her purpose, was to bring, especially when you've got this prophecy saying, wow, this great blessing is going to come through all mankind, and she's not getting it done. So it's like, wow, this big weight upon her head. So the idea of childbearing, huge thing. So it's like, do you want to be executed or barren? Wow, that is quite the choice that you're facing. But it goes back to the central point of the spirit of jealousy. What is actually going on there? Is that something that people just, you start going off in what we call the jealous rage and just start throwing accusations around and saying, okay, you know, you've been unfaithful? And, you know, you hear accounts of it on a regular basis where people fly off the handle and, they do terrible things to each other out of these fits of jealous rage, we call them. But what is it that's actually being talked about here? What is the picture of this? Because a lot of these things are what you see happening, but what is the thing you see happening supposed to teach you about this? Is the point here just about, okay, this is how you order a culture? Or is it beyond that, to what is it that God is trying to teach you? Because the whole thing about this tent and everything goes on in the tent is all about, it says, the picture that's shown to you on the mountain about God's house. This is God's embassy on earth. What is he trying to get across? Even today, every embassy has an ambassador, and the ambassador is operating with the direction of the head of state of the country he comes from, with a message that the ambassador is bringing. Every ambassador brings a message. how they act, what they say, what they do, what they don't do, all is bringing forth a message. So the things that are happening related to the tabernacle is all a message about something that's going on. So thus, you can start seeing a little bit of a picture of, oh, I think we've seen some of these other pictures, like the book of Amos might come to mind, about a prophet who was told to go marry a specifically adulterous woman. Oh, Samson. Hosea. I don't know why I was thinking Amos. Yes, thank you. Hosea. And Hosea being one we're talked about. Now, what was the picture there of Hosea? Was that about just making the prophet crazy? Or was it about something that was really tearing at the heart of God, in that no matter what he has done for the people, take him out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, no matter all of it, they still just keep running off to this and to that, to something better. Use whatever metaphor you want, the grass being greener on the other side, you know, whatever it is that they thought was better, they went off running off after it. That was the lesson there. And you start seeing hints of that in this picture of the jealous husband, of, you know, when you look at how grave the situation is here, where you're actually like digging up dirt out of the floor of the tabernacle to go mix this in, when you're thinking about ink and dirt, okay, it's nasty, but it's not deadly, and nothing in that is literally going to actually affect your anatomy much, maybe make you a little bit sick, but not to the point of infertility. So something else is going on here that God wants us to see. Something else related to purity inside of the people. And when you see the picture of harlotry is one term that's used throughout the prophets, even in the latter part of Deuteronomy, it talks about the future of the people of Israel. This adultery, harlotry, being pictures of the people themselves running off after some other, quote, husband, unquote. The people being the bride and God being the husband, running off. So you need to start making little notes in your mind. Hey, that sounds familiar. It sounds like stuff you hear about in Revelation, about the city of God descending out, like a bride adorned for her husband. And Paul talks about the bride of Messiah. That those pictures that we have there is a lot of what is getting at with this. Is this just all about, you know, trying to do one over on the wife into a terrible catch-22, and the husband just gets off scot-free for leveling this kind of an accusation? Or is it something, a picture that you want to try to get an understanding of where God is going with this? So let's kind of hit the rewind tape and catch the first part of this, talking about the roles for the priesthood in these different parts here. Now, one of the things that you're just noting out of this is in Numbers 1 and 2, it's, of course, talking about the census there, first starting with the people and the army of God, the beginning part, and then it starts moving into the separation, and really in chapter 3 of Numbers, the separation of Levi, the tribe, the branch of Levi, from the rest of the people. They become kind of in a separate track off of there, to the point of their firstborn, and then the firstborn of the firstborn, which is where you've got Levi coming off the family there. They are set apart as special. And then they get not only carried into a counting, but also given special jobs within the embassy of God, the tabernacle.
So going back to what I was asking about earlier, and the names in the 12 tribes, mm-hmm. and of course the tribe of how do you say it, levy. They sleep inside the tabernacle?
More like around it.
Because I remember the placement he's talking about. It's like four of these are going to be on the north side, four of these are going to be on the south, and four on the east, four on the west. But there's no mention of where Levi is, and when you look at it, you got four on each side.
Right, and they're just kind of like 12, they're kind of like in a perimeter around it, where you have actually the family of kind of hit the rewind tape a little bit, and it talks about Moshe and Aharon, and they sit right at the front door. So you got the high priesthood and such; they're right camped at the front door. But Levi, in particular, is just they're in a perimeter all the way around it. They're kind of like a little bit of
the
a
first
bit,
guard, or the
yeah,
inner
the
guard.
First the first guard, and we'll actually get when we start talking about these three families within Levi, you start noticing what their delegated roles are. And first off, you've got Kohats, or the Kohathites. Their leader, it talks about their leader. The term for that in Hebrew is Nasi. You may have heard that term. They came down through time as being like the president of the... you'll see it referred to in the apostolic writings as, you know, the leader of the synagogue. Well, this is the term for that is Nasi. It's sometimes translated president, but just means like the leader, the head honcho. So the head honcho of each of these groups. You have Elisaphan, the son of Uzziel, and out of Kohath are the high priests, which Aharon comes, his family comes out of this group, because Levi had three known sons here that are recorded, Kohath, Gershom, and Merari. And out of Kohath is where Aharon's comes from. His father, Amram, came out of Kohath. And so you got General Levi. They're the set-apart group for being the perimeter of God's house. And then you've got the subsections of them being divided into these separate groups. And the duties that are noted for Kohath are the Ark of the Testimony, the table, the bread of presence, the menorah, the altars, the utensils of the sanctuary, the veil. That's kind of when the portion ends, there's the first 20 verses of chapter 4. So that's where the last portion ended with talking about Kohath and their responsibility. But those items, the Ark of the Testimony, the table, the bread of the presence, table of showbread, also talked about menorah, the altars, the utensil of the sanctuary, the veil. What are all those things kind of have in common? No, Holy of Holies, but when it talks about altars, that's another. You got one, the incense, one that sits right there at the veil, and then you got the one that's outside. Okay. Another way to put that is those are kind of like the touch points between heaven and the people. Those are where the korbanot, the offerings, they come in and they have some sort of a touch point with them, with the offerings of the people. The offerings, the people coming in for the bread that goes on the table. The offerings of the oil that goes into the menorah. The offerings of the incense that goes into the altar of the incense. The main altar outside into the general court areas where the sacrifices that of those type of the korbanot come in and get offered there. These are like interaction points of where the gifts, what the people are bringing in, bringing themselves in, where that interaction happens between heaven and earth. And that's where Kohath. And you also notice that a lot of those items, when you remember back from Exodus, where these things are described, the latter chapters of Exodus, a lot of these things had carrying poles on them. So when it talks about this whole thing of Naso, all this taking up, all these things being taken up here, all these items pretty much, except for the veil, didn't have poles on it, specifically had a pole to hang it on, but not a pole to actually carry it with. But everything else that's kind of noted here for Kohath were things that they had carrying poles specifically on. So they were specifically, Kohat was taking up the touch points. They were bearing the burden of assembling these places between heaven and earth that they'd interact with the people. Now, and you look into Gershon. Yes.
So the Kohath are among the sons of Levi. So they are part of the Levi or Levi.
Yes, because Levi had three sons. One was Kohath, Gershon, and Merari. Yeah, and then out of Kohath came Amram, who was the father of Moshe and Aharon and Miriam. And then, of course, out of Aharon come the high priests. So with Gershon, we got the head honcho there is Elisaph, the son of Lael. And their duties were, talks about there in verses 21 through 28 of chapter 4. And also talked about back in chapter 3, verses 21 through 26. Their duties were the tabernacle tent, its covering, the screen for the doorway of the tent. So you got the tent over the Holy of Holies and the holy place, and also the screen for the doorway to the tent. The curtains of the court are all around the tent, and then the screen for the doorway to the court, and all the cords that go with it. So their responsibility was to basically protect the people from the otherness, the holiness, the glory of God. Because it talks about, you know, that God had to have some sort of a covering to protect the people from being destroyed. To actually be in the midst of the people, yet be covered and prevent the glory of God, his otherness, from destroying the people. So, these, one way to put what their duty was to actually being a bit of a covering of the people. So where Kohath were bearing up the kind of the touch points directly between the receiving the gifts, receiving actually the by substitution, the people themselves toward God, the Gershon was to cover over what was happening within God's house, to actually a protection of the people. So to kind of allow them to come into God's presence in a way that would help them, not hurt them. And so you got the outer perimeter of where the camp of the Levites were, all the way around the tabernacle. Then you've got what the Gershomites built in the covering for the tent itself, the holy place and the most holy place, and the courtyard all around it. Now, Merar, with Merari, the head honcho was Zuriel, the son of Abihail, and their duties were basically the frames. The frames of the Mishkan, where the place of the Shekhinah, the tabernacle, the bars, the pillars, the sockets, and then the outer court. So where Gershon was all about the barriers, the physical barriers that were protecting the people from the glory of God, the Merari was all about the structure that those coverings went on. So those two actually worked together in protecting the people from the glory of God and from their own curiosity or arrogance or ignorance of what the danger it was of just wandering in to God whenever they felt like it. One of the things that we can pick up from all this is that you could easily said, well, why not just have one, you know, or the other, Gershom or Merari? They could just do the whole thing. If you're putting up the structure of the stuff, why don't you just have the same people put the coverings on it? You know, what do you have to like delegate it so much that one person puts up the structure, they can't put the textile over it? But one of the things that you look at here is that these are not only the division of labor, but also division of specialties. With making textiles, which is what the people of Gershom would have to put up with, is different from mechanics and hardware and keeping, you know, casting molds for the stuff. Because if you remember back in Exodus, all of the rings that held up the curtains and the poles and bases for the poles, a lot of casting, a lot of woodwork, a lot of mechanics went into putting the framework together. And Gershom was all about textiles and a whole lot of textiles. I mean, talking lots and lots of cloth, keeping it new stuff, repairing it, you know, making it beautiful, nice. Of course, you know, dyeing the clothes. It's not like you can just go down there and you know, buy, oh, I want so many yards of purple and whatever. No. If you want purple cloth, you got to make purple. You got to make the dye, then you got to dye the cloth. So a whole lot of production went into the textiles. You know, so you had to either get the wool or the cotton or whatever you're going to make it from. And then talking about the skins that went over the holy place itself, you know, there's a lot of tanning that is involved in that. So a whole lot went into the production of those coverings. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So these are basically like, you know, Merari would be like the framers, and Gershom would be like the drywallers and the, you know, siding folk and whatever, the roofers would be coming in to do that sort of thing. And, you know, they would be like the cabinetry folk, the furniture makers, those kinds of things. And, you know, I've only had small dealings with cabinetry work and drywall, and wow, those are very specialized things that if you don't do it a whole lot, dropping into it is definitely a challenging thing to actually be efficient doing it. And that is a large building, and especially taking it up and putting it down on a regular basis. Wow. But one of the great lessons that we can get in this is that, especially like with Merar, where they were just making framing, is that even the stuff that you don't maybe necessarily notice, like framing, is hugely important. And when we think about, and Paul talks about the various parts, the members of the body of Messiah, each of these parts is hugely important, even the things that you say, they don't matter. And they don't matter much. The covering hangs on it. What the Merari does is absolutely essential. It's essential. Because Kohat wouldn't be able to do his work. Gershom wouldn't be able to do his work unless you had Merari there to make the framing. So the stuff that seems like it doesn't matter much in operation of what God does is hugely important. You read about that in Acts where eventually the apostles say, we need people who are just specifically there to the day-to-day operations. We call them deacons, so that they're the ministers, basically the people who just get stuff done, stuff that needs to be done. And when you look at Stephan, these are definitely not any sort of you could say slackers, because Stephan, you say, well, wow, isn't that? Why wasn't that guy like an evangelist? You know, why wasn't he one of the prophets? Because when you see him spout off that sermon right before his death, that's like, wow, come up with something like that on the fly. That guy studied a whole lot. He was just totally filled with the Spirit of God to just be able to pick all that stuff out from all of his knowledge of the word just on the fly. But his delegated job was to make sure that people got fed and make sure that those who had needs within the congregation, that those needs were taken care of. So that's a huge lesson for us, and that the things that we think are inconsequential are hugely essential, which goes back to, as we started our discussion here today, is why didn't they just say, et cetera, et cetera, there in chapter 7? Why list the same thing 12 times? Each one of them had all their gifts listed every single time, and they were all the same. I mean, you could have just changed the words, a couple of words, and it would be exactly the same every single time. The point is that every single one of those tribes mattered. they were all part of a whole. Because when you saw the summary later, all of their gifts added up to, and you start noticing these numbers at the end here, about 60s and 24s, 12s. These are all numbers that you see a whole lot throughout God's Word because they're significant. They're all about, you know, either completeness, things reaching a 12 times 24. These are things that really show us that the whole is important and the parts are important. Both of them are important. You have to have the whole to really be a family of God, and you have to have the individuals to be a family of God, which is a lot of what Paul gets at there in Romans, kind of like, what is it, 9, 10, 11, where he starts talking about the various elements of the family of God. It's like, okay, you folk who are been close to God, Yehuda, the Jews, you've grown up around him. Okay, that's fantastic. But what about the nations? What about them? The ones that God is drawing in, calling in to? All have to be brought in. He talks about once, you know, the fullness of the nations come in, you know, then it's kind of, all right, then we start working on any of those who are, talks about being temporarily blinded or whatnot, then the fullness of Israel is foreseen. That's really a great picture, because when you look at Israel's history, and you look at that list of the tribes, 12 tribes, most of those are, you know, can you say, oh yeah, we're gonna go visit Issachar today. Just get on a plane and go visit Issachar. People have ideas and notions where those people went, but you can't just go and visit Issachar today. Where do they go? People have notions, but you don't really know. Zebulun? Dan? Know where these folk are? People have ideas, but today you can only really know for certain kind of where you have a place called Yehuda, and those lineages go from all kinds of different places, and you can see people around with names like Cohen or Cohen or something like that, and they all kind of go back to the idea of priesthood and kind of trace back up to Levi. But other than that, it's really kind of hard to tell where these places are. But God's idea is that we're going to have a great bringing back of all of the nations in, not just people who just happen to be born into the family, the people who truly are in the family. As Messiah said, you know, it's like God can create out of stones sons of Abraham who are part of this promise. So it's not just about where you were born into it. It's about where you finish, where you attach yourself. Are you like Ruth, who say, your people are my people. Your God is my God. Or are you like some of those later on in Israel's history, where it's like, you know, oh, really, the God stuff again? Kind of get tired of God. That's born into it. Kind of their lineage is that, but getting tired of the things of God. And
so I'm just curious, where did they put all these offerings at?
Where did they put them? They brought them in with the carts, and they talked about that they gave them to the priesthood, because one of the things that you'll see at the beginning of this is that there's kind of like the cedar fund for getting these offerings going. So they gave them over to the priests, because remember that this chapter kind of chronologically could be inserted back in the last few chapters of Exodus. Because if you look back there in the construction of the tabernacle, and then it goes through the 7 days of consecrating the priesthood and such, this is kind of where that fits in, kind of chronologically, is back at that particular time period.
So were they literally being sacrificed day after day after day in those 12, or did the priests wait, and then at a certain time all these animals were sacrificed?
Oh, bringing these offerings in?
Yeah. When did it happen? Did it happen when they brought it, or did they wait and the priest did it later? Hmm. Just thinking in my mind, if they did it, they brought it, how gory and stinky and...
Yeah, well, you also see the dedication of Solomon's temple. That was a lot more than this. It was a tremendous, tremendous number. And even when you see what's listed there in the dedication of Solomon's temple, that paled by comparison. As much as that was, that paled by comparison to what Passover was like at the time of Messiah, time of Yeshua. I mean, see, Josephus talks about like millions of people. A couple million people were coming in at that particular time period. It was a whole lot, a lot more than Solomon, a lot more than this particular time period comes in. And so when you're talking about gory, yeah, that is very, very gory. Now see, that I don't know. I don't know if they were actually bringing and doing the sacrifice. It just says that they came in and they gave them over to the priesthood.
So I need some clarification on this. So in my mind, it's saying to me that this was like the beginning. This was like all these tribes, they did their census. They all have this sin. They all brought forth their offerings. And at that point, you know, it was kind of like almost like a clean slate. They all gave their offerings. Now they're good to go. And as they went through their livelihoods, that's when they kept bringing up, you know, when they would have guilt offering or sin offering. But this was like the first offering. Like, you know, as you say, dedication to the temple.
Yeah, this is the ribbon cutting.
So this is like their first offerings from every tribe. They're doing this part. And then from then on, it'll be like, you know, when we go farther.
There's the free will offerings. Right. And then a lot of those guilt and sin offerings and such either came at specific, like the appointments, the great anniversaries that we have on the calendar of like Passover and Shavuot and Sukkot and such, or they come about because of especially the guilt offerings, and some of those are related to actual judicial decisions that then are, because one of the conceptions that people have is that, you know, every time I goof up, then I go take a sacrifice down there. But they were more along the lines of, it was a goof up to the point of there being a judicial decision. And then part of the judicial decision was involving the sacrifices and the restitution and the, you know, paying a fine and such like that. So that's where a lot of those come from. So, but that would then suggest the question after that. Well, it's like, do you just get off if no one catches you? Well, you could think that. And actually, when you look in Israel's history, a whole lot of people thought that later on in Israel's history. It's like, you know, we're doing this and no one sees it. God doesn't see it.
I was just thinking to myself as I was going through some of this and reading it this morning, I was thinking, you know, it's like, you know, here I come to the priest, you know, with my unblemished lamb and my doves, and he's like, Dave, this is like the third time today, you know, kind of mentality. And it's like, but the clarity of like having to go through the actual due process for the offering and the penalty just makes complete sense.
Yeah, and the whole thing about witnesses really comes into play when in John, you see the Gospel of John, it talked about that when they're asking, well, who's vouching for you? And he says, well, you know, the Father's vouching for me and such. That idea of the witness being, God sees what's going on here. Don't think you're whatever you're doing, God does not see it. Whether you're plotting, whether you're conniving, whether you're cheating, stealing, whatever you're doing, short cheating people, not seeing the needs of the people around you, don't think that God is not seeing what is going on here. And that's what a lot of the prophets were getting at too. It's like, who are you kidding? You think that you're doing all this stuff and God doesn't notice any of this? You know, and then you show up at the altar and you think everything's okay and God didn't notice? Like, just because there was no human witnesses to it doesn't mean that God did not witness what actually happened. So that's what kind of what Messiah's point there in Matthew 18. It's like, you come up to the altar, and the general context is thought that they're probably talking about the shalom offering, which is the peace offering, which is meant to come after you go through the whole process, after a judicial thing, and you go through all the various sin and guilt offerings and such. And the last thing is the peace offering, which means, hey, God, you and I are now cool. It's everything that was against us before is now gone. We are now at peace. There's this wellness between us now. So you're going to come to the altar and bring this gift saying, hey, God, everything is cool between us, yet still somebody has something against you. It was like God said, well, there's really, you may think there's peace between us, but I still see some, what's going on there. There's still some sort of problem that needs to get resolved. Go resolve it. And then come back. Leave it there. And the idea being, hey, you know, it still needs to be, get resolved here, but you need to leave it there and then go resolve it and then come back. It's not that God just doesn't ever want to have this shalom. He just says there's something that's missing. The shalom is not total. So it's really a good lesson to us. It's like we can go through life and just think, you know, ah, well, that's okay. I'll just, you know, pray and ask for forgiveness and that everything is cool. And that's the best thing about, you know, Messiah. Messiah covers. But what is it that we are leaving out? You know, what part of our heart is still not totally fully given over to be covered, if there's still something that's lingering out there? And you kind of get this picture with Matthew 18, that there's a bit of either from one side or the other, or maybe a mixture of the two, as you've noticed in life, there being a little mixture of both people in a dispute and resolution. So go get resolution on these matters, then come back. Which also kind of gets at this thing of the jealous husband. If it's gotten to this point where you would seriously have this kind of an accusation being leveled, wow, something has seriously happened to this relationship. Because, you know, you just think about this. You go through this and it gets adjudicated and, quote, everything is fine. Wow. What then sort of happens to the relationship afterward of you go through this? Wow. Talking about loss of trust, loss of closeness together, this animosity between the two. That's like something that you don't do lightly. You don't look to go into this kind of situation. You look to avoid it as much as you possibly can. So that's a little bit of a note in there. One of the things as we move on here into chapter 5, this removal of the unclean, removal of the unclean from the camp, as it talks about. Now, you know, people through hundreds of years, actually, probably a couple thousand years, have really kind of struggled with this. It's like, okay, you take people who were in these various states of unclean out of the camp. You see that specifically with leprosy, as we read earlier in Leviticus, about the stages of leprosy and being outside the camp, and then, you know, the various stages of checking this to see if the condition continues. So that's clearly outside the camp. But then you see in Leviticus, as we read, the people with these other kinds of issues, whether it's, you know, it's a periodic thing that happens in the body, or if it's some sort of extraneous thing that happens, the body is not whole, or things are just not some sort of periodic bodily function. Do those people go like completely outside the camp and are banished from the camp totally? No, And that's why people were thinking, well, maybe then we should look at what this idea of camp is. And the picture then comes down about a scene as like three different camps. You've got the camp of the Shekhinah, as Shekinah, which is the camp of where God's presence is specifically camped. And where is that? That's the tent, inside the tent, inside the court. So that's where the Shekhinah is specifically camped out. Then you've got the other camp, and we kind of talked about that, is the periphery of this. You have the courtyard around it, and the people who maintain the courtyard around it are the Levites. So you've got Levi around the outside. So the idea is then you have the camp of Levi. They're kind of regulating the flow of people into the inner, the camp of the Shekhinah. And then outside of the camp of Levi is the camp of Yisrael. So you kind of got three stages of camps. Now, for those that are even have some sort of a, as we talked about, the Tameh as it is in Hebrew, where you're unfit to go into the direct presence of God, that's just in the direct presence of God. You're not banished totally outside the camp for all time. So the picture came in is that, you know, except for like leprosy, which is like something where you're totally outside on the periphery, that these things are, you're just out excluded outside the basically to the camp of Israel, which is basically where everybody else lives. You're for that period, you're not able to actually go in and approach closer. So when you see the picture in the Gospels of the woman who was bleeding for 12 years, so 12 years she was not able to go to the temple. It's like, wow, that's kind of the thing of being excluded out there for 12 years. And then to come up to a teacher and get that touch, that direct connection, and get healing from that. It's like, wow, even out here in the camp of Israel, God still comes out here too. And that's one of the great pictures is that even though God specifically says, I've got my quarantine presence inside here, the camp of the Shekhinah, God's not just doesn't live there. He's everywhere and is accessible to anyone. It's just, you know, the specific presence of God, you just have to understand that God is different from the way the world works, the way the world operates. That's what the lesson of the whole tent is all about.
Since we know the Lord takes care of everyone, like you say, I mean, you know, he wants us to know him. I don't recall of any scriptures that say how the lepers were to be cared for outside the camp. You know, I mean, I know the Lord Jesus saw lepers and he healed lepers, but all I know in my own mind are the history of leper colonies, and certain people have gone there and helped those people who were very contagious and also very needy. And I don't know of any scriptures that tell you, except, you know, if you have a sore or whatever, go to the priest and he's supposed to do certain things and over time examine that sore. But where is the goodness and kindness of the Lord for the leper colony? Or what, you know, the outside of the camp, untouchables.
The one thing that is good to know is what did we learn from Leviticus about becoming Tameh? And the lepers, even though they were sort of like in a, depending on the state of their condition, they could be in a state of dying, but maybe not. They weren't a corpse. And even if they were a corpse, you know, you end up having a purification thing. And there were people who dealt with corpses. That was their job. They dealt with corpses. There were other people who dealt with people with various conditions. Now, if you were, think about just in general sicknesses, If you touch somebody or came in contact with some sort of blood thing or whatever, that made you tamei. But that was only until evening, and then you wash yourself and on you go. So the point being is that that's one of the great lessons of the parable of the Good Samaritan, was that can you be, quote, inconvenienced in your life to go help people who need help? Now, you know, it talks about the various people who came by and saw this man laying there. Now, you know, a little peek under the hood there in Leviticus, you can see what that would mean. If that person that was actually dead, then you would have to deal with the corpse, and there would be, you know, for the Levites, you know, he would be pretty much off duty to do anything involved with anything related to the temple. He was even involved in the temple. And if the person was injured or they got bloody and this and that and the other, so then you end up having to do the purification thing if you're wanting to go into the temple. But the point was, is that did you even inconvenience yourself that much? And you saw, it talks about in the parable of the Samaritan, he went farther than that. He not only picked him up, he washed him off, dressed his wounds, put him up in a hotel, and then paid for it in advance and went off and then came back. So that's one of the great pictures there when we talk about lepers or anyone else, that woman who was there hemorrhaging for 12 years, because the people who took care of her, they were inconveniencing themselves. That's sort of a picture, is something that we have to remember, that sometimes we have to inconvenience ourselves for the needs of the other people around us. And when we think about inconveniencing ourselves, we just went through talking about the Shemitah year. That's huge inconvenience. And think about the letting all your servants go and their contracts go, and letting land revert back to other people. Talk about huge inconvenience. So much of an inconvenience, it was hardly ever done. And even when they realized that their lives were at stake and that of the nation, they sort of did it and then realized, nah, we can't do this. And then took it back. And then the nation imploded and they went off into exile. So it's like, even when your life is at stake, you know, can you even be inconvenienced that much? And that's really, I guess, one of the sad lessons in Israel's history, is that the concern for other people has to be there, and looking at where your utter goal is, your utter vision. Do you see yourself dwelling like David, there you long to dwell in the presence of God? You long to, like, dwell in the house of God. Kings just can't go, some kings tried to go waltzing into the temple and such and didn't go well, but or just kings in general, they weren't part of levies, so they just couldn't go in what they wanted. But for David, he longed to be in there. He longed to be there in God's presence, even if he physically couldn't be there. So that for us, if something that we want to do gets inconvenienced by something that we should do, looking around at the needs of people, that's a part of that golden rule again, you know. Would we want someone to be inconvenienced to help us? So sometimes we may need to be inconvenienced to help somebody else. But in the end, who is the one who greatly inconvenienced himself? That's Messiah. That's what Isaiah 53 prophecy is all about. It's about someone who didn't have to, wasn't anything of his fault, but he took it all upon himself. Took the sicknesses, the infirmities, everything upon himself. Not just inconvenienced, I mean, just lowered, debased, all for the sake of other people. And so when we talk about taking upon ourselves the cross of Messiah, that's what that's all about. It's getting inconvenienced for the sake of other people. And when we talk about inconvenience, that's where the Nazarite comes in. the Nazarite vow, people over time after, you know, this was written, sort of came up, well, what is a Nazarite vow? And so when you look at some of the oral writings, there's a whole section in the Mishnah and the Talmud called Nazir. It's a big section where people wrestle with this idea of how does one, when it talks about, okay, you stop, you're ending a vow. Well, how do you start a vow? How long does it last? You know, can you just inadvertently just declare yourself to be in a vow? What does that mean? And some of the things that they wrestle with from the scriptures is elements such as, you know, it's not going into something just casually. Nazarite vow is not a casual thing. It is, when you talk about the things that you're abstaining from, anything related to grapes become like toxic waste to you. You cannot be around any byproducts of grapes or such. And, you know, you are dedicating yourself and have this physical sign of your hair and your hair growing, whether you're a man or a woman. And it's kind of an interesting thing of that this is a completely egalitarian vow in that it's something that applies equally to men and women as far as donating your hair. And for the Nazir, their Nazir, their crown, their consecration is their hair, versus the priest is the crown that's on the turban, the cap that the high priest wears. He's got that Nazir on his front, the gold plate that says holy to the Lord. For the Nazir, their holy to the Lord is their actual hair from the time that they started the vow and dedicating that over. So you get a little kind of picture of that later on when Paul is talking about hair and those kinds of considerations of whether it's good to have long hair or not long hair, what picture are you sending? Then you've got kind of some overtones of some of the cultural practices in the Greco-Roman world at the time, where you had some people who were kind of not very distinctive in their type of dress and were kind of dressed like male or female or something like that. So Paul was saying, you know, it's that hair thing is a symbol in the people of God of something that a connection that you have in a special vow. Mm-hmm. Right?
With accused of guys, when he was being accused of not keeping the commandments.
Ah, yes. Okay, that's right. Yeah, you see, the first you see that is over in Acts chapter 18. In Acts chapter 18, verse 18, it talks about that he. So take a look at this specifically, Acts chapter 18, verse 18. So Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of his brethren and put to sea at Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Centuria, he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. Now, when you look at the word, there's only really one thing where a vow and cutting your hair is all about. And that's the Nazarite vow. So this is a specific thing. So this is beyond chapter 21 of Acts, where you see it again, where he went through and sponsored these four Nazarim who were going through to get they were going to the end of a vow. And as we're reading there in Numbers chapter 6, this is a 7-day process, where they were going through to come to the end of their vow, and there's a number of offerings that they give at the end of their vow, and they present at the temple with their offerings their hair that had grown during the time of their vow. So this is in a couple of cases where Paul is recorded as being involved with a Nazarite vow, either with them or he himself being involved with a vow. And one of the things that was quite interesting with chapter 21 is some were thinking that perhaps Paul's involvement with those Nazir at the temple was perhaps related to chapter 18, because some of the writings of the first century talk about if you take a Nazir vow and you're outside of the land, I mean, it's not feasible for you to get to the temple, the start of your vow or whatever. So, and you end your vow, you basically then, when you get into the land, then you go through the completion of your vow. So perhaps what we're reading in Acts chapter 21 is related to what we see earlier, is that when you get into the land, when he was actually there, then he was able to go through the completion of it. And the Nazir vow is not only one, it's voluntary. Number two, it's, you could say, kind of obscure among the practices. People just didn't do that among their daily practice. Oh, I'm going to be a Nazir today. Well, it's something that doesn't, you don't enter in lightly, you don't end lightly. If something happens in the interim, as you read Numbers chapter 6, it's like, it's not an oopsie sort of thing, as you have to go through a process of like recognizing, wow, I was in a serious relationship of service to God, and I violated it, so I have to end it now. And it's a kind of a recognizing that something has severely ended. So the point that he was at the temple and ending this vow in a going through the 7 days with these other Nazir there, that truly would probably show those who are wondering, well, did Paul just kind of cast off the Torah, as some were accusing him of doing? Was he just casting that stuff off? By going through the closing ceremony of a Nazir, that's would probably show, it's like, wow, even down to the kind of iota of the little yod of the Torah, that he was still said, hey, that is something still important after the cross.
Sorry, I'm a little confused. I'm not quite sure what a vow is. If a vow is a good thing or a bad thing, is it if you're shaving your head, are you stepping down from, you know, are you like going through a cleansing period? I mean, stepping away for a minute to cleanse yourself, to be pure, to purify yourself so that you can go back to being a faithful man of Yeshua. I mean, I'm not sure.
Yeah, when you see the Nazir vow as it's here in Numbers, those were, you know, primarily people who served in the temple themselves. They were like the ones who were, you know, that was the, we talked about before about the exclusion zone from the tabernacle for those who weren't priests. One of the exceptions, general exception for that, is the Nazirs, who were worked together with the priesthood to do stuff. They weren't Levites, but they were sort of acted together with the Levites to do stuff related to the tabernacle. And so that's when you read about, you know, Shimshon or Samson. He was declared a Nazir from birth. There you read it. Yeah, I know. He was from the tribe of Dan, I think, or one of the other tribes out there. But he was pledged. That was kind of his thing. He was going to be one from birth. So, which is very odd, because you see this, I think, if you don't just kind of fall into it, but his mission, his dedication from birth was to be a Nazir. Yeah, he was talking about being dedicated there, but what is his background? Yeah, so he was from the tribe of Levi. Now, I don't know exactly if he was from, you know, the family of Aharon, but he was at least from Levi. So his idea of being dedicated to the temple may not have been so odd, but the picture of that sort of a nazir, someone who is excluding himself from various things, the picture you get of perhaps Yochanan or John the Baptist, picture it gets sort of looking like a bit of a nazir. Some people think that the pledge that Yeshua took there at it's known as the Last Supper, that I'm not going to drink of this fruit of the vine again until I drink it anew in the kingdom, that perhaps that is sort of like a nazir thing. But the root of a nazir is for someone to get closer to God, be connected with God for specific service for a certain period of time. And so you see with Paul being outside the land on his journeys, for him, perhaps it was a thing like, okay, I am going to this, because when you enter in a nazir, vow, you are saying, I pledge myself to do this. Think of today, we got kind of flippant pledges like at a fraternity or something like that, where you say, I dedicate myself to do all kinds of crazy things that they tell me to do. Well, for a nazir, this was like incredibly solemn, and that's why a lot of the wording that you get related to a nazir is similar to the wording of consecrating a priest. It's like, this is serious business here. This is not something flippant yet you're going into. So for Paul, who said he was from the tribe of Benjamin, for him, he was kind of acting, going into a very rigorous dedication of his life to God. Now, for the temple that he was serving, as be the greater house of God outside of the land, kind of working for the embassies of God that were there in the various places he was visiting. So I don't know if that kind of helps a little bit with that picture of what the Nazir vow is. A vow is, in general, it's just saying, I will do this. And a lot of times it has some sort of a thing that's it is a pledge. You're saying, that's why, when I talk about vows and pledges, not all pledges were vows. Sometimes pledges were just collateral for a loan or something like that. That's what it talks about for someone who's poor, and they pledge their coat because that's all they got, and say like, I will do this and I'm giving you my coat. And that's how serious I am about doing this. So you're like, okay, but kind of stop short of turning the screw to them as to when it's cold and they actually need their coat. Either kind of release them from the rest of their obligation and give them back their coat, or find some way to bring that pledge in for a landing, so to speak. But the idea of pledge, today we talk about collateral. If you don't pay your mortgage, they take your house. You don't pay your car payment, they take your car. That we have that idea of collateral. That's really what the pledge was about. The vows were one step beyond that. It's, I'm going to do this. Oaths are more like, this is a co-signer on whatever, like a co-signer on your mortgage. That's what the oath was all about. That's why oaths and co-signing is equally dangerous, I guess you could say, is because you are now saying, oh, I'm going to do this. But just like with co-signing, you don't know if the other person is actually going to make all their payments or do. Yes, exactly right. Yes. So just like with what Proverbs is warning about it, Yeshua warns about it. It's like better not to make any oaths at all. You either say you're going to do it and you do it, or you don't. It's better to leave it at that, because especially with oaths, because oaths often, especially in the realm of the time period and the people we're talking about here, it would probably involve something related to God, like God's furniture, and taking an oath by the temple and as kind of a stand-in for God. Some people wouldn't be as brash, but sometimes they were, as taking a pledge by God himself. But wow, that's pretty brazen. But the idea being, it's you either do it or you don't. Don't try to make it pump up your oath by dragging someone else into it. You know, having God, so to speak, co-sign on your loan by invoking his name, and I swear by so-and-so that I'm going to do this. You either do it or you don't. So I don't know if that kind of brings into the focus a bit of where these all fit together in talking about the purity of Israel, that all of these people are carrying along together. They're all carrying a burden together. The burden is the presence of God on earth. That's what the Mishkan is all about. Shachan, which is where you get Mishkan from, means like a dwelling place. And you put the little mem or the m type letter in front of it, and it means the place of the dwelling is what Mishkan means, which is what the tabernacle is often called. It's the place of the dwelling. Now, interestingly enough, even though it's a different spelling, Shekhinah is a sense of the place of the dwelling. Even though they're sort of different words, a different spelling versus Shachan and the Shachin, where you have in the Shekhinah, it's interesting that you get the same general picture of the presence of God being somewhere. And that's kind of where the interesting play on words between the Nazar, from where you get Nazir and the Nazirite, means like a crown consecrated, set apart for something. And the Natsar, which is the branch, which is where in the prophets, like especially Isaiah, talks about the Natsar of Jesse, or the branch of Jesse, being a term for the Messiah. So he will be called a Nazarene. He will be called a Nazarene. Kind of an interesting little play on words there, because actually both apply, really. Being crowned, consecrated for a certain task, his task there as the Messiah, which in itself is also a term of anointing, being set aside for a certain purpose, and also the special branch off of this root that comes from the great line of Jesse and King David. So both of those apply to Messiah in that regard. I don't know if this journey through this passage here has seen what it is that God is trying to get across with all this picture of the priests and all that they do, really a picture of the body of Messiah and all of its parts working together with one goal, and that goal is to bring those who are far off, those who don't know God, aren't close to God, to bring them near. That's what the priesthood did. That's what the body of Messiah does, to bring those who are far off, to bring them near. And also, to once you are close to God, then how do you stay close to God? And the part of the Nazir, the meaning of the Nazir vow is really, you go all in with God. You're putting all your chips forward, all of it. You're putting all of it in. That's what the Nazirs did, dedicating it all for their term of service. So when Paul talks about a bondservant of Christ, that's really what the Nazir. The Nazir became the bondservant of God. They became the servant for the time period that they were in there. And that relationship, the picture that we have of the jealous husband, you know, that's really a better and fuller picture of what God is feeling like with a people that just, you know, no matter how good he's being, they still want to go off and do something else. Something else is a little bit more of a shiny object than what God is providing. And the offerings that all the 12 tribes are bringing in, showing every little part matters and it adds up to the whole. So just like the role of the priests, also the gifts of the tribes, kind of showing the same picture. You're all a part of what's going on here together. So I hope that's kind of a great message that we can take forward into this, is that whatever role that God has us in, another scripture there, whatever God has you do, do it with all your might. That's probably a good way to sum up this entire passage here, is that if God has shown you that you have some sort of role in his kingdom, just go for it. Go all in on it. Any last thoughts as we close out here? All right. Well, let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us this picture of your kingdom and our place in it. We thank you for the great honor that you've given us to be inside your house. And Father, we thank you for having mercy on us, for cleaning us up, and for setting us off in a new direction as new people. Father, we just ask for more of your Spirit's power to move forward in this new life you've given us, this new purpose, to dedicate our whole life to you, not just parts or certain hours of it. We thank you for these things. In the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.